Hi everyone, and welcome to the American Higher Ed Podcast. My name is Alicia Waddy, and I am joined today by my two esteemed colleagues, Madeline and Angelina. Today, we will be discussing a history of affirmative action in higher education. We'll be focusing on its origins, the impact that affirmative action specifically had on college and university admissions, and where affirmative action stands in contemporary times. Before we get into the meat of the podcast, we'll each give a little introduction of ourselves. So like I said, I'm Alicia, and I'm currently in my second semester of the Higher Education and Student Affairs Administration, or HESA, program at Buffalo State University. I am currently working in the Student Accessibility Services Office at Buff State as a graduate assistant. In this position, I'm working directly with students with disabilities, addressing their executive functioning concerns, and assisting them to overcome challenges to succeed in and out of academics. I had previously worked as a campus advocate, where I assisted students, faculty, and staff who had experienced sexual and/or domestic violence. In this experience, I saw how many people, departments, and institutions needed to collaborate to offer the best support to survivors. And because of this experience, and because I have always believed that college is a home away from home for students, I wanted to be a part of the process to ensure that these students are supported in all ways possible to ensure that they have a safe, comfortable place to grow, learn, and develop.
Hi everyone, my name is Angelina and I am in my first semester of the Higher Education and Student Affairs Administration program at Buffalo State University, and currently I am working in the Office of Residence Life at Buff State, and I am an Assistant Complex Director, which means I am overseeing a dorm complex in tandem with my supervisor, who is a full-time complex director, and we work together to ensure there's a positive learning environment being fostered within our building and residence halls across campus. We also do programming centered around student needs and train our student staff to assist us in providing this experience as well. Previously, I've worked within student resource centers where I was able to facilitate programs around education experiences and different skills to set them up for success within college, such as financial aid, learning about restorative justice, and similar topics. And my passion for student affairs comes from the way I was brought up in student affairs. I have a strong passion for making students feel like they're at home, making students feel like they can succeed in any environment they want to. And so that is about me and my knowledge and interest in this topic.
Those intros were both very like meaningful. I'll try to match that energy. My name is Madeline Reichler. I am currently in my first semester of the HESA program here at Buff State. As well as being a student, I am also a grad assistant in the Academic Center for Excellence, where I work as a lead mentor and office assistant. So I work with the student tutors to help support the services of the center in offering academic support to the student body and helping students be successful, learn study skills, learn how to learn, you know, more effectively, and help to offer, you know, promote the center services, offer events, that kind of thing. And previous to this, I was a staff member at Genesee Community College in Batavia for 4 years. That's my professional background in higher ed. And I worked in student engagement and inclusion as a community diversity and equity specialist. So it was very much a role focused on student activities, student life, planning events for students, a myriad of different types of events, as well as supporting student clubs and organizations, including cultural clubs and student activist groups, all kinds of student clubs, and also working to provide a variety of other services for the college, like overseeing the student food pantry. So that's my professional background. And I, what brought me to higher ed was kind of my experience in undergrad, just kind of seeing how there are so many aspects of a student's experience that can really like enrich their time in college. And college should be a place where everyone has the chance to flourish. And I want to be a part of that, especially for students who have been historically underrepresented in higher education and who need, who need a welcoming environment and who need, you know, resources that were created with them in mind. So that's kind of my goal in higher ed, is to help create that equalizing and uplifting force that we kind of idealize it to be. So that's us. And as Alicia mentioned at the top of the podcast, we are going to be talking about affirmative action today as our topic. This is a really broad topic with, you know, a lot to cover. In order to kind of get a handle on it, we'll be honing in on a number of things. So first, Alicia is going to be talking about the origins of affirmative action. So its historical origins back in the mid 20th century, the road to educational inclusion, the key milestones and policies that had that set affirmative action into motion, and some of the beginning impacts of affirmative action, and some of the early challenges to affirmative action as well. Angelina is then going to be talking about the impact of affirmative action over time. So how colleges and universities became more racially diverse and inclusive under the affirmative action in college admissions practices. Some challenges to affirmative action practices or with the implementation of affirmative action. Some court cases that arose surrounding affirmative action, those who benefited and those who were forgotten in the process of these policies that were instituted. And then lastly, I will be talking about the contemporary picture of affirmative action. So more recent times, the more recent legal challenges and Supreme Court cases that have taken place to challenge affirmative action in college admissions, the impact of affirmative action more recently, and also the impact of affirmative action bans. And then touching on where we stand today in the United States with race-conscious affirmative actions and college admissions, and where we are going, or, you know, where we think we may be going. So that kind of gives you an outline of what we will be discussing, and I will throw back to Angelina.
Yeah, and so throughout our conversation discussing the topics that Madeline outlined for us, we'll be sharing evidence in support of our position that race-based affirmative action in college admissions supports the diversification of the university student population and contributes to a more equitable system of higher education. And our take on this is both informed by our experiences through our current positions and program we're enrolled in, as well as research we've done outside on the topic. So I will throw it to Alicia for our first section.
Thank you both so much. So I figured that we would start with defining what affirmative action is. So a modern day definition would be an effort to increase opportunities for racial and ethnic groups that face barriers advancing in the workplace and other institutions, including higher education. Higher education will be the topic of our podcast for today. The original term entered the public lexicon through Executive Order 10925, initiated by President John F. Kennedy, in 1961. This initial installment was to ensure that federal contractors take action to ensure that individuals were treated without regard to race, treated fairly. The initial step only addressed racial discrimination in employment, but as we'll discuss later, and as we keep reiterating, this was adopted into college admissions. So why was this action needed in general? Well, affirmative action came about to address rampant and severe discrimination that people of color had experienced for centuries. This can be traced all the way back to the enslavement of Black people, thinking about disproportionate land allocation that benefited white citizens, different discriminatory government actions, and also historic violence against people of color from groups like the KKK. There were also major federal programs like the Social Security Act of 1935 and the GI Bill that contributed to disproportionate benefits being offered to white Americans, which oftentimes excluded Black Americans and other people of color, and limiting their access to these resources entirely, and oftentimes only uplifting white people. These all applied to the realm of education. So, let's discuss the road to educational inclusion. Desegregation was of the utmost importance when it came to creating racially inclusive schools. The United States has a racist past within secondary and post-secondary institutions that activists and proponents for racial equality have fought hard to right-size. The legal journey for this goal in higher education started with the Supreme Court's Brown v. Board of Education decision in 1954. This case overturned the separate but equal doctrine and really set forth a momentum to integrate schools. This path was solidified by two key elements that will be further addressed in both this section and in some of my colleagues' section, and that will be Title VI of the Civil Rights Act and the 1978 Supreme Court decision of Regents of the University of California versus Bakke. So looking at policies and legislation, we saw pushes for racial justice in the realm of employment as early as 1941. So President Franklin D. Roosevelt issued Executive Order 8802, which prohibited racial discrimination in employment for workers in any defense industries and other government sectors. And this discrimination, this prohibited discrimination based on race, creed, color, or national origin. As I stated earlier in defining affirmative action, in 1961, President Kennedy's Executive Order 10925 created a mandate to ensure that applicants and employees alike were treated fairly without regard to their race, gender, or national origin. So kind of building off of what FDR originally set in place about 20 years prior. These policies set a tone for desegregation and improving employment opportunities for people of color in the United States. In 1965, Executive Order 11246 was passed under President Lyndon B. Johnson to further ensure that government contractors had affirmative action measures to meet certain levels of minority employment, addressing the underutilization of women in employment sectors as well. So this, again, built off of previous executive orders, previous legislation, and this was all kind of looking more at employment. Hiring quotas were soon put in place in 1970 under President Richard Nixon via Order Number 4. This was expanded to federal government contractors to ensure desegregation in employment practices. And universities soon followed suit in the early implementation of affirmative action in college admissions with similar quotas, racial quotas, to put it. These quotas would soon be pushed back against, and affirmative action will see its first challenge through the Supreme Court. With these legislations, it's kind of coming to fruition that there are sentiments for racial justice and inclusion. And this was also echoed in 1964 when the Civil Rights Act was passed. And this strengthened voting rights and addressed desegregation of public facilities and public schools. As I mentioned before, Title VI of this act played an important role in setting up affirmative action in colleges and universities. So Title VI was significant because it prohibited discrimination in programs receiving federal assistance. So it mandated that federal funds were only provided to educational programs that ensured equal educational opportunities regardless of race. This provision also granted the federal government a considerable amount of authority to promote and enforce desegregation efforts. So again, utilizing these laws and legislations, all of these happening alongside the civil rights movement, and as the civil rights movement gained momentum, race-conscious affirmative action settled into college admissions. There was a growing recognition that mere non-discrimination and integration wasn't enough to correct the centuries of racial exclusion. So public universities in particular began taking charge as early as 1964 to make changes, and Harvard specifically started making changes for racial inclusion around 1961. This shift represented a conscious effort by institutions to address the severe underrepresentation of minority students and the use of race as a specific factor to build a diverse student body. This was done to actively counteract the historical exclusion and systemic barriers faced by people of color in accessing higher education. So while all of this is going on and universities are becoming much more diverse and we're seeing inclusion happening, we are also starting to see the first major pushback against affirmative action in the regions of the University of California versus Bakke case in 1978. So to give a little background, Alan Bakke was a white applicant, and he argued that he was denied admission to the medical school of the University of California at Davis twice, despite his stellar academic credentials, due to a specific racial quota. Those same quotas systems that I mentioned earlier had been adopted by this university in the 1970s. In this ruling, the Supreme Court decision was critical. So it rejected the use of rigid quotas, finding they were unconstitutional and infringed on the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. However, it affirmed the importance of diversity in higher education and allowed race to be considered as one factor in a holistic admissions process. It also ruled in favor of affirmative action, which is important to note. I also wanted to note that affirmative action didn't necessarily touch on or resolve fundamental structures of racism, but it definitely had a massive impact on access to education. So for example, in 1960, African American college enrollment was barely 200,000 students, and nearly three quarters of that number were students enrolled at HBCUs. By the 1970s, the enrollment numbers reached 417,000. By 1975, the number of African Americans under the age 35 with a college degree had jumped from 96,200 in 1960 to 341,000 people. And this momentum continued between 1989 and 2002, the number of African Americans receiving professional degrees rose by 70%. Enrollment of Black students in law schools jumped 50% between 1990 and 2000. These numbers show a clear opening of doors via affirmative action that had long been closed. And this is all wonderful that we are hearing that all of this is happening, but these doors, so to speak, haven't always been appreciated by all. Oftentimes, critics argue for a race-neutral, colorblind meritocracy as a way for admissions into college, suggesting that policies like affirmative action are forms of reverse discrimination. However, many scholars do point that this rhetoric threatens to reverse civil rights progress. We'll discuss later a more recent Supreme Court case that pushes for an emphasis of the colorblind approach to college admissions. We also do want to note that despite the progress in education, significant disparities continue to persist, especially when we look outside the black and white dichotomy. So sociologist Manning Marable once asked, if diversity is our greatest strength, why are Latino and Black jobless rates still 2 to 2.5 times that for whites? If we all value diversity in workplaces, why are our residential districts in America still so heavily segregated by race? The history of affirmative action is the history of America grappling with its past and attempting to create a future where educational opportunity is truly inclusive for all races, genders, and ethnicities. So we just looked at the beginnings of affirmative action, starting as pushes for diversity in employment and morphing into college admissions practices. Now we're going to look at these practices in action. So Angelina, can you dive us into some more successes and challenges to affirmative action?
Absolutely. So, looking into the implementations that universities have taken to meet expectations surrounding affirmative action, we see that institutions begin to include diversity largely into their admissions process. And as diversity grows on campuses, we see that the way of socialization within education is shifting, and it begins changing because of the different identities and backgrounds that are now mingling in higher education spaces. So the affirmative action movement in racial diversity admissions was set out on the goal to ensure that the student population was growing and changing to be a group of individuals that are different from each other and in turn are also learning from each other. And as I stated before, this exposure to a diverse population would oppose the previous environment of uniformity. And this shift created some very interesting outcomes and reactions from the public, from people wanting to go to college, and resulted in a lot of discourse, but also a lot of uplift that we see change within the socioeconomic statuses of individuals. And so that brings me to one of my first points, which when I was researching the effects of affirmative action within college admissions, I came across several instances of the term interest convergence being used, which was a new term to me. And the term was set to propose the theory or the thought that racial segregation in schools would not have been eradicated if it were just about Black children gaining education, as that was the initial thought back in history, and that racial integration was made possible because it converged with white interests, because, as we know throughout history, that has been the race largely in power and the ones that built the systems that we still use today. And as they built the systems, they changed them based to how they see fit. And with that explanation, I wanted to call on my esteemed colleagues to see what they think about this this quote that I'm about to read. So the quote is, the interests of Blacks in achieving racial equality will be accommodated only when it converges with the interests of white.
So I found the term interest convergence to be really interesting. I don't think I've seen that term before, but I've kind of seen like the idea be discussed before. So it's cool to learn a term for it. I can wrap my head around the theory. Like I can see, I think it does make sense because obviously, obviously without like the tireless activism in the Black community to advocate for rights and to advocate for desegregation and integration, that wouldn't have happened. But the white majority, held the majority of the power, and so it took, cross-racial solidarity for integration to be codified into law. And there were still a lot of people who resisted it, and continue to resist it. But I think it took the convincing of enough white people that it was in their best interest for racial equality to be pursued, and for them to actually support it, because to desegregate and to actually, undergo the process of desegregation does mean that white people have to kind of give up the advantages they are conferred by racism. And so people feel protective of what they have and protective of those advantages, even though they're not fair advantages. But if people can be convinced that that equalizing is still in their best interest, because it, to have a more diverse and fair and just society is in everyone's best interest, and they will benefit from, being a part of that fairer society, then I think that, I think that that's when movement happens. So I do think there has to be the cross-racial solidarity, and there has to be action on the part of white people for that kind of thing to happen. So I would say I agree. All that being said.
I would also agree, and I would echo a lot of the same sentiments that you just shared, Madeline. And I think the most important point that you made in that was that there needs to be that cross-racial involvement to have this full integration moment, this full integration in society in general. Another really great point that you brought up was that white people need to kind of give up the power and privileges that they have been unfairly given, and oftentimes without any work towards what they were given too, especially thinking of like critical race theory, and that being one of the sentiments that or of white privilege, excuse me, that these privileges are afforded to white people simply because of the color of their skin. So, yes, the convergence of interests with white people, I think, did need to happen, and still continues to need to happen in order to have this kind of, I guess, harmonious kind of setting.
For sure. Thank you for both of your inputs on the term interest convergence. And I did want to add that, like, this, the article where I found this term most used in was focusing on the binary of white people and black people and kind of their history. So not many of the other minorities were being mentioned within this article. But just wanted to apply it to also maybe what we have seen recently with the people in power taking away systems that do benefit people that are not white and are not privileged in that way. And so just to draw it back to minorities as a whole, and just wanted to note that about the specific language being used. And so moving on from this discussion of people in power onto something a bit, well, not a bit related, very related. So these people were given countless opportunities, and these opportunities were because the people in power shared the identity that the privileged people have, which are white people, because they were previously thought of as racially superior. And so when the thought process begins to shift and we start to think about how other communities are affected by the previous prioritization of the people in power, the people who are benefiting from this racist thought process and the people who are benefiting from the privilege that they hold in the system will be causing discourse and voicing that discourse and making a lot of cases. And the reasoning behind these cases are extremely interesting and I would say almost shocking. I say almost shocking because the history, especially in this country and around the world, the racist behaviors have persisted in the past, and we even see it in the present today.
Yeah, I wanted to interject and say that kind of what you're bringing up is sounds kind of like what was mentioned previously with the University of California versus Bakke, if I'm on the right page. Feels like the outrage that was had over admissions during that time and how it was unfair to those who came from privilege.
Yes, exactly. And there were multiple instances of this outrage that applicants who were looking for higher education, they started voicing it in various instances, and these individuals took legal action. And you did touch on the Bakke case a bit earlier. And in my portion, I would like to focus on another case, or rather cases, and that would be speaking a bit about the case of Abigail Fisher and the University of Texas at Austin, and how Fisher's legal team sought to make her case one to represent the harm that they claimed affirmative action and race-conscious decisions in college admission was causing to certain individuals. And so, just for some background, Abigail Fisher was a white applicant who was denied admission to the University of Texas at Austin, and she her initial allegation of being denied admission was because she claimed it was due to her race and her being white, and that the other applicants of minorities had an advantage over her. Her initial approach will be referred to as Fisher One. And then there was a second phase of her legal action, which I will refer to as Fisher Two. And so Fisher decided that since she was facing what she perceived as racism in her admissions process, she decided to sue the university. And during Fisher One, the lower courts that she took her case to, decided that her case was not valid, and the university has an explicit statement to narrowly tailor their admissions process to include the increase of diversity on their campus, as their campus was lacking in diversity. And so the lower court ruled that. Then the lower court sent this case to the Supreme Court. And again, this is Fisher Part One, but the Supreme Court ruled that the lower court's ruling was inefficient and didn't have enough evidence because of the phrasing narrowly tailored, which isn't a direct attack to the university's mission of increasing diversity, but it was more so a technicality. And that is how Fisher Part One concluded, was the Supreme Court sending her case back to the lower courts. Now, Fisher Part Two. So after the lower court reviewed the case once again, they decided to uphold the University of Texas's admissions policy because they specified the numbers of the reasoning behind their quote narrowly tailored admissions process, which was because, for example, in 2002, 52% of undergraduate classes with at least five students had no African American students enrolled in them, and 27% had only one African American student. And so this was one of many reasonings and data that they presented to the lower courts that they used as support for their case and for their mission of race-conscious admissions. And so the lower court sent this up to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court looked at everything and said that, yes, what the university is saying makes sense. And the court decided to uphold the University of Texas's admissions policy and their race-conscious admissions. And this is all to make a point of saying that I personally feel like this was a lot of commotion for it to be the original decision, like for it to be upheld in the way the university already explained to Fisher before she even took legal action, which I just wanted to highlight because when coming across court cases and affirmative action and admissions, you come across a lot of entitlement, and this entitlement was born from the injustices that these people have, that these underserved communities have faced. And I think this is a way that these like racist thought processes do persist even today. Because affirmative action and college admissions is still a part of the conversation, especially with our current administration, which we'll be getting into later. So, shifting from one case that the anti-affirmative action side attempted to make as like a spotlight on why affirmative action is harmful, comes another case which I found interesting as the people in power, white people, attempted to use Asian Americans for their case that affirmative action is harmful. And this is because a narrative was being floated around that affirmative action harms white and Asian Americans due to their merit being overlooked due to their race. There seemed to be a moment where admissions or college campuses, rather, had a large population of white people and Asian people compared to other minorities. And narrative being floated around that their merit was being overlooked just because of their race and just because they felt like they weren't getting into their school of choice, just because the school was looking to diversify their campus and they didn't seem to fit that narrative. This can be seen in multiple perspectives, but a large portion of the evidence presented leads me to believe that white people were using Asian Americans as their poster child for anti-affirmative action cause, because they would cite their stellar academic records, perfect test scores, but they were still being rejected. And the reason that I say that it felt so polarizing was because the current academic admission system still overly favored white people. The academic admission system previous to affirmative action initiatives, this still favored white people more than Asian Americans who were not being admitted as widely as their white counterparts. A case that supported this, which we can talk about more later, I believe, was Grutter and Bollinger, was a case that presented evidence that an increase in diversity benefits everyone in higher education because it leads people to colleges that introduce them to different backgrounds and identities. And this fusion of culture and ways of living equip those with valuable experiences than if there was less diversity. And I also wanted to note that with this whole narrative. And speaking about the ethnicity of Asian, a lot of different identities fall under the term Asian, as Asia is a large continent. And there are a large amount of Indian American and Korean Americans enrolled or that hold college educations that disproportionately outweigh the other groupings of people that fall under the Asian identity. And so I feel like that's an important note to make as we have been discussing the importance of those who have maybe been left out of the conversation of affirmative action and those who have been more in the spotlight. And for one of my last points and one of my last thoughts to leave this section off with would be the term colorblindness. This was a term ideology that many anti-affirmative action individuals believed would be a solution to the misrepresentation or to the alleged racism they are facing in college admissions. Colorblindness refers to not looking at race or the skin color of people at all. Essentially claiming that their race or skin color have no impact on how they're treated or what opportunities are given to them, and completely erases that part of their identity. Colorblindness is a harmful ideology, but was used as a potential solution for people against affirmative action in terms of race-conscious college admissions. In concluding my section, there were many positive outcomes as institutions strive to reach their goals of diversifying their campus to foster a more impactful, supportive college campus. I know we focused largely on a lot of controversies and challenges that were faced, but I also would like to highlight that many minorities have been given the opportunity to climb that socioeconomic ladder that they might not have been able to previously to affirmative action, and that many studies have been conducted on individuals who come from less diverse populations. Being enrolled in a diverse college campus has led to more positive race attitudes and has also led as a whole to more civic engagement, being engaged in community, and being invested in others, not because they look like you, but because you embrace learning from each other and learning from differences, which could be also described as becoming a lifelong learner, quote. And so, with all that being said, I am passing it over to our contemporary issues with Madeline.
Thank you. That was a great transition. I like kind of the nuance that you talked about these issues with, like, kind of the advancements we've seen in diversity because of affirmative action, and also the challenges and people who have kind of been disadvantaged or not fully served. I liked your comment on how the term Asian, how the racial construct of, like, Asian, quote unquote, is constructed of, like, of so many different, people of different ancestries and ethnicities. And it's, a really the way we define race legally in the United States really can be reductive in how it groups so many people together, and groups of people who have different, sort of histories and standings in the educational system in the United States, and have experienced different injustices throughout history, and just, are very different from each other, which is true for every racial group. But I liked how you pointed that out.
Thank you.
So I'm going to be talking about contemporary issues of affirmative action. So I'm going to be focusing a lot on the legal challenges, Supreme Court cases, and bans that we have seen in the last, 30 or so years, affecting affirmative action in college admissions, race-based affirmative action in college admissions, I should say. So for one thing, I looked at a pretty recent New York Times analysis that talked about the impact of affirmative action admissions policies on racial diversity at PWIs, predominantly white institutions, specifically between 1980 and 2015. So Alicia, you had highlighted how when affirmative action was first established in admissions, we saw that really big jump in the number of Black students who were enrolled in college between between the 60s and the 70s, I think is sort of the period that you were talking about. And it was like, this huge increase. So following that, between 1980 and 2015, the gap between the percentage of college age population that is Black and the percentage of freshman enrollment that is made up of Black students, according to this analysis, it had not changed significantly, meaning that the gap, that equity gap, basically, that gap that demonstrates that underrepresentation of Black students in higher education has not closed. And then the gap for Hispanic students between those in the college age population and those who are actually enrolled in college and what percent they make up of college enrollment, that gap has actually widened since 1980, between 1980 and 2015, I should say, as the population of young Hispanic people in the United States has grown a lot in that time. The percent of them who are enrolled in college has not grown with that number, basically. So the gap has widened there. At the same time, white students have remained kind of consistently overrepresented in higher education, represented in terms of their percentage of the total college age population versus their population in higher education. And Asian American students, as that is defined, have become more greatly overrepresented. So all that is to say that affirmative action in the last few decades leading up to 2015, there were some advancements in racial diversity, but those gaps never really closed. That's important to know, I think, because I think sometimes in the most current and like topical conversations about affirmative action, it seems like maybe people are under the impression or operate under the assumption that those gaps closed in the past and those gaps are no longer present. But we see that that's not true. And we also know that affirmative action in college admissions on its own has not been enough to close those gaps. So I think that's also an important thing to notice is the limitation there. We never eliminated the underrepresentation of students of color in higher education with affirmative action. And I think there are many reasons for that. Just to name a few, there are still a lot of ways that minority serving K-12 schools are being under-resourced. So obviously these schools are feeding into the college age population, and we still have a lot of social inequity in the K-12 educational system. That is one thing that can affect enrollment with or without affirmative action policies. These things also are related to family income and socioeconomic status. So many K through 12 schools are under-resourced. Specifically, school districts are very racially segregated for historical reasons, and that is still true today. And the schools that serve the most racially minoritized students are some of the least resourced as well. So socioeconomic status and race are correlated in that way, to the point that some states have responded to affirmative action bans, which I will get to and talk about in more depth. Some have responded to those bans by seeking to increase access to public universities for underserved students by instituting policies where they automatically offer admission to the top 10% of ranked students from every school in the state, regardless of regardless of their grades, sort of in a vacuum, if they were top 10% performing at their school, with the intention that that would control for schools that are more or less rigorous or have, higher performing academics or have more resources. And this was intended to benefit racially minoritized students by proxy of these school demographics and by proxy of benefiting people from under-resourced schools. So that is kind of one thing that some states have done. And some examples of states that have done that are California and Texas. Also in Michigan, they've also tried to target low-income students to try to maintain racial diversity in their school system without using race-conscious admissions by offering more scholarships to low-income students, college prep classes, and reducing early admissions acceptances, which disproportionately, early admission and early decision admissions policies disproportionately benefit higher-income families and white students. They're disproportionately utilizing those. So reducing those is intended to be like an equity measure. Even despite those efforts that kind of are intended to help lower income students and by virtue of doing so, help racially minoritized students, underrepresented students find their way to college. These things have not decreased the racial gaps that widened. That widened in those states after affirmative action was banned. One of the quotes that I found when I was reading about this was from the University of Michigan undergraduate admissions director, Erica Sanders, and she was quoted as saying, "Socioeconomic status is not a proxy for race."
Which I think that is quite a ridiculous statement. If you are going to no longer uphold race-conscious affirmative action within your institutions, but you're also not going to be looking at socioeconomic status as well, unless I'm misinterpreting what you're saying, then it just seems like they don't want specific groups of people at their institution. Am I interpreting that correctly?
Well, it's kind of, all this is to say that there are many reasons why between 1980 and 2015, those racial gaps in representation in higher ed have been maintained. And part of the reason for that is these state interventions where maybe they've, on a statewide basis, they've banned race-conscious admissions practices, but they've kind of tried to use other means to maintain racial diversity or increase racial diversity, but without using race-conscious admissions. In those sort of like state case studies, it seems like that has not been successful. So that's been like an ongoing challenge. So it's kind of, I see what you're saying, Alicia. It's like, it's difficult to kind of have the goal of, you know, the stated goal of racial diversity. However, you don't have a reality of racial diversity, and then your methods of pursuing racial diversity cannot be on the basis of, you know, considering race as one factor for admission. So, yeah, kind of interesting. Did I kind of address what you were saying?
I think so.
Okay. So just a couple other things that have, you know, maintained that challenge of closing the racial representation gaps. Predominantly white institutions can have challenging climates for students of color. So the fewer students of color and students from underrepresented racial groups that are present on a campus, the more difficult it is to create a welcoming environment and a positive climate for them, and it's more likely to be unwelcoming and hostile. So that is, you know, throughout what I was reading, it was often commented upon by students, minoritized students who are currently attending PWIs. And that can kind of perpetuate, it's sort of a cyclical problem if you don't already have a diverse student body and also a diverse faculty and staff. It's difficult to attract and maintain students of color because they arrive to the campus and it's like, whoa, this isn't for me. You know, the environment is not inviting to me. And, you know, it's easy to understand why that would make things more difficult. So those are just a few things that kind of help to contextualize those persistent gaps. Lots of things, you know, are a part of that. So that was kind of that's been persistent throughout time. And then I'm also going to talk about some legal challenges that has that have been a part of the conversation about affirmative action throughout that period as well. So these, you know, as we've been saying, affirmative action in college admissions has been like a contentious topic basically for the entire length of its existence, and people have persistently challenged it and criticized it, and it's been challenged legally a number of times. So the first notable case of that happening was in 1978. Alicia, you talked about this briefly during your part, but it was the case titled Regents of the University of California versus I've heard Baki, and I tried to look it up and I got conflicting information, so sorry in advance if that is not the correct pronunciation. We do not have Baki on the pod today to share what the correct pronunciation is. But this case in 1978 was the first time that affirmative action, race conscious affirmative action in college admissions made it to the Supreme Court. And the ruling by the Supreme Court upheld affirmative action in college admissions. And so they ruled against the plaintiff in that case to uphold the policy. But there were several major impacts of this case. One just being that colleges and universities can pursue racial diversity as a valid goal. So in terms of choosing who they admit and who they want to kind of, choosing what they want to achieve in their admissions choices in order to create the college population that they want and to kind of curate that community that they want. Pursuing racial diversity is a valid goal. It's valid in this way that admitting students on their merits and on their achievements and on other traits is valid. It can be used, it, they ruled that race can be used as a factor in admissions as long as it's not the only factor that admissions offices use to decide if an applicant will be accepted. And they also ruled that racial quotas were unconstitutional. So race has to be considered as a factor, or it can be considered as an individual factor for admission, but it can't be so simple as a number system that you have to meet a quota for certain racial diversity requirements. It has to be a little bit more like subjective and nebulous than that. It can't just be a quota. And that was an important distinction. And also, the last notable thing that was determined in this case was that institutions cannot separate students into different candidate pools for admissions. So the University of California was system was having like a separate pool for racially underrepresented students, and they were like pulling from that pool to meet the quota, and then they had like the pool of like non-minority students. And it was ruled that they couldn't do that either. It has to be one candidate pool. Race has to be only one factor in determining a candidate's fitness for, admission, and that they couldn't use quotas. So that was major. And then there was, that was major. It was impactful. And it set the precedent, that the United States legal system, was protecting this policy practice. It would be in 2003 that affirmative action would hit the Supreme Court again. And there were two high-profile lawsuits filed by white students against the University of Michigan, that challenged race-conscious affirmative action. So these cases were also impactful and impacted public perceptions of affirmative action. This was a long time after the California case, but these two cases also ended up with the Supreme Court ruling in favor of ruling in basically to uphold affirmative action practices. So one case was Rutter versus Bollinger. And in that case, the court ruled that the university could continue to use race as a factor in admissions decisions as long as other factors were still considered. An interesting thing about the ruling on this case is that the justices ended their opinion by writing, race-conscious admissions policies must be limited in time. The court expects that 25 years from now, and note again that this was in 2003, the court expects that 25 years from now, the use of racial preferences will no longer be necessary to further the interest approved today. So that was what, 22 years ago. And not to spoil anything, but the most recent ruling on affirmative action, that was in 2023, so just about 20 years. What do you all think of that quote? The court expects that 25 years from now, the use of racial preferences will no longer be necessary to further the interests approved today, while they were protecting race-conscious admissions practices. Do you think that was like idealistic? Do you think that it was, do you agree with that sentiment and like that timeline that they imagined? I don't know. What do you think?
It kind of feels odd. It feels like an arbitrary number. that was just chosen? How do you know that in 25 years that race conscious affirmative action wouldn't be needed in schools anymore? It's also obviously nobody can really look into the future, but there were still disproportionate impacts to minoritized individuals, especially minority students entering into universities in 2003. And trends, yes, they were on upward tick, as we saw, due to these affirmative action practices in college admissions. So I just think it is, like I said, how do they know 25 years would be the limit? And also, we see that the gap is persistent. Even from that New York Times analysis between 1980 and 2015, 2003 falls within that range. So we can still see that this gap is massive. So I'm no legal savant or anything, but my opinion is, how do we know 25 years? And also, we're seeing outside trends that don't line up with a complete cutoff of affirmative action.
I will say, I think when I was reading about this, the justice who wrote the majority opinion, and I can't recall her name, but they wrote that into the opinion. And then the article I was reading said that like they didn't all necessarily agree with the statement. Like it said like Ruth Bader Ginsburg was like, "What? I didn't say that. Nuh-uh. 25 years. Like I don't agree." So it was definitely. I don't think it was. Their, universal opinion even back then. And I agree with you. I don't understand exactly where the 25-year thing came from. And also that when we did see the nationwide ban in 2023, it was not because of no more racial gaps in higher ed, but for, other reasons. So we didn't see those gaps close. Angelina, did you have anything to add?
Yeah, I think I'm just on the same page as both of you. The 25 years is very peculiar to me, and I don't know if optimistic is the right word. Maybe tone deaf, but I feel like even today there's still a lot of work to do. I guess especially today with how the current administration is handling a lot of things in higher education and their attitudes towards diversity. So I do find that quote very kind of jarring, honestly.
It is interesting. It, I guess hindsight is 2020, but it seems a little wacky now. But, we know what we know. So that was Rutter v. Bollinger. And then the other case, the companion case, as we say, for this case was Gratz or Grotz v. Bollinger. Bollinger was the last name of the university president, I believe. So that was the University of Michigan side, and Grotz was the other defendant. So in this case, the court actually ruled that the university could not continue to use its current admissions system, that they had like a point system where it was. It graded prospective students out of 150 points, and students could guarantee their admission by earning 100 points based on various metrics. The point system gave an automatic 20-point bonus to students who belonged to a racially underrepresented group. The court ruled that this form of race-conscious affirmative action was not constitutional, because it was too close to like a racial quota system, which was following the precedent of the 1978 case that stated that schools cannot use a quota system to determine their student admissions. And they basically said that the assessment of prospective students who applied to the school needed to be more individualized rather than using the point system, which, you know, I can see the rationale behind that. It seems very rigid, and I see the idea behind it. I also see the problems with it. So those were the two cases in the two Michigan cases in 2003 that were like kind of another major point on the timeline for legal challenges to affirmative action. Notably, Michigan, after the Supreme Court sided with the University of Michigan and allowed them to continue their race conscious admissions practices, Michigan would later in 2006 ban affirmative action via ballot initiative, which I will talk about in just a minute. And then I just want to note also that the 1978 ruling from the University of California and the 2003 rulings for the University of Michigan would both be effectively overruled by the 2023 ruling in the case of Students for Fair Admissions versus Harvard, which I will also talk about a little bit more later. So those were the Supreme Court cases, again, prior to 2023. But there were some statewide bans of race-conscious affirmative action that were put into place outside of just the Supreme Court cases and outside of the legal cases. There were states on an individual basis that banned the practices at various times. The first of those was California, actually, which I was, when I first learned this, I was a little bit surprised because I was like, what, California? Maybe not the first place I would have assumed would do this. But it was Proposition 209 in California, which was also known as the California Civil Rights Initiative. This was in 1996. Californians voted by ballot initiative to ban race-based affirmative action in both public employment and education. So across the board, but including education. This was the first contemporary state-level legal ban that we saw. And then the immediate results of that, which has, you know, was documented and, you know, we know for a fact occurred, was that there was a measurable decrease in the percentage of Black and Hispanic students enrolled in California state colleges and universities. So that was the first state to ban affirmative action in admissions, and the first state where, you know, the effects could be measured. That ban in California set a precedent of sorts, and between 1996 and 2023, eight other states would follow California and ban affirmative action in college admissions as well. Those states being Washington, Florida, Michigan, Nebraska, Arizona, New Hampshire, Oklahoma, and most recently, Idaho. Idaho was in 2020, I believe. Something interesting to note is that five of those bans were by ballot-initiated constitutional amendment, meaning that the voters in that state made the decision. They voted on it and voted to ban affirmative action in college admissions. Affirmative action lost on the ballot in those five states. It was also on a ballot in Colorado. So there could have been nine other states, but the initiative narrowly failed, and so people did not vote to ban affirmative action in Colorado. The bans in those other states shared very similar language to Proposition 209, so California was definitely used as a precedent. And there have also been some efforts in the years since 1996 to unban affirmative action. Like, it's been back as a ballot initiative several times, including in 2020, most recently. And they've voted against unbanning it like a number of times. So been a tough gig for affirmative action in California. It's interesting to kind of look at these public votes on affirmative action when it gets put to a public vote, because it's almost like confusing to look at public opinion on race-based affirmative action. This conversation is, I feel like our current conversations about it, like in the past few years, it's been a huge topic. It's been very polarizing. It's been at times confusing and frustrating to have the conversation, because it's so hard to kind of like parse out people's beliefs and the reasons behind their beliefs. And I found some research that kind of supports this impression that it's a polarizing and confusing topic, and that public opinion on it is very mixed. So in 2019, Pew Research Center did a survey and found that 61% of Americans said they favored affirmative action for minorities in college admissions. However, they also did a survey in 2019 that found that most Americans, 73%, thought colleges and universities should not consider race or ethnicity when making decisions about student admissions. So those things are kind of confusing because it seems like when asked about it in one way, people favored it. When asked about it in another way, people did not favor it, which leads me to feel like the language that's used to frame the issue seems to have a big impact on people's opinions. Interestingly, this is how California's Prop 209 was worded. So this is what people were voting on, yes or no. And this was the text. It said, "The state shall not discriminate against or grant preferential treatment to any individual or group on the basis of race, sex, color, ethnicity, or national origin in the operation of public employment, public education, or public contracting." I think it's interesting to hear that language because I can kind of understand where that confusion comes in that the language of the state shall not discriminate, no preferential treatment. It sounds like, oh, yes, I support equality, therefore I will support this ban. However, if you frame it more like the state will support historically marginalized, underrepresented, under-resourced groups, people feel differently. So I think that the confusing aspect of it is sort of the equity conversation. Are we assuming people start on equal footing and they are getting unfairly granted preferential treatment, or are we assuming people are not on equal footing? And we know from our research that, and from the reality of history, that people aren't on equal footing. So those were the state bans that were instituted before affirmative action was banned nationwide. And there were some measured impacts of these state bans. So a 2012 study that I found showed that following state affirmative action bans, Black undergraduate enrollment dropped by about 25% and Hispanic undergraduate enrollment by about 20% at the affected institutions. One report used national data from the US Department of Education for institutions admitted students' SAT scores to show that after affirmative action was banned, schools were not admitting better credentialed students following the bans. One of the arguments in favor of banning affirmative action is that it would allow colleges and universities to admit better credentialed students who were higher performing academically, like admitting the best, the most merit. But the results of this study actually showed, based on the data, that it really wasn't the case that they were admitting higher performing, better credentialed students. And then a 2020 study on economic mobility after the passage of California's Prop 209 found that the ban hurt Black and Hispanic student educational outcomes, which contributed to a 5% annual decline in wages through their early 30s. At the same time, white and Asian students did not see significant benefits to their economic mobility. I have a quote. It's a little bit long, so I don't want to necessarily read it out verbatim. But basically, it was this interesting thing they observed where another kind of idea that people, you know, that people rallied behind in support of banning affirmative action was that in, you know, taking away spots from, you know, white and Asian American students who were demographically overrepresented in colleges and universities, you know, in giving those, you know, in giving more spots to people who are racially minoritized and taking away those spots from white students, you know, or overrepresented students, you know, they will lose out on that economic mobility. They will lose out on the, you know, on income. They will have, you know, they will have economic disadvantages. But this research was showing that after affirmative action was banned, Black and Hispanic students saw economic disadvantages in the long term, but the white and Asian American students didn't really see advantages. They had similar outcomes. So it disadvantaged the already minoritized students and then didn't really yield like a proportional advantage to the students who had been more privileged. So I thought that was interesting. And then another consequence of bans was that was observed to be that one study I found showed that in California, after affirmative action was banned, there was an avalanche effect on college admissions, quote unquote avalanche effect, where high performing racially underrepresented students would enroll at less selective institutions instead of more of them getting into the really selective institutions. They enrolled at those less selective institutions. And then as a result of that, they quote unquote, like pushed out less qualified underrepresented students who previously like could have had seats at those less selective institutions. And then those students kind of moved to less selective, even less selective institutions. And kind of there was this like pushing down effect, this avalanche effect of students going to less and less selective institutions, which eventually resulted in more underrepresented students increasing their enrollment at exploitative like for-profit colleges and universities that are like the least selective and the most predatory in their admissions practices and have the most predatory like financial practices. So that's definitely a negative effect. And then also another result of affirmative action bans is that not only do you see, you know, maintained or widening racial gaps in college enrollment, but also racial gaps in professional fields that, you know, people who are attending college are eventually going into. So fields like medicine, law, engineering, technology, and also university faculty, the racial gaps increased in those as well because the system wasn't, the system wasn't advancing students from racially underrepresented groups. So those were some consequences that were observed. And so finally, I want to talk about Students for Fair Admissions versus Harvard, which is the 2023 Supreme Court case that resulted in the nationwide ban of affirmative action in college admissions, or race-conscious affirmative action in college admissions. So it started as a 2014 lawsuit that alleged Harvard's admissions practices were discriminatory against Asian American applicants. And in 2023, the Supreme Court ruled in favor of the plaintiffs, saying that race-based affirmative action in college admissions is unconstitutional.
I also kind of read through this case, and I also wanted to mention that though there was this nationwide ban of race-based affirmative action in college admissions, there was kind of a, so to speak, a small crack left in the door to how colleges can consider an applicant's discussion of how race affected or quote, how race affected his or her life, be it through discrimination, inspiration, or otherwise. And that's provided that this admissions consideration is connected to that person's individual experience and their own unique contributions during the admissions process as well. So there is hope.
Yeah, so that's a good thought. It's kind of, there's a limiting factor. However, there are still ways that, you know, maybe these effects could be mitigated. I think that, you know, it's a very dynamic landscape right now. This ban is still very recent and the impacts are still being kind of sussed out. Since this was only 2 years ago that the ruling came out, although institutions were kind of preparing for that outcome before then. Although it was recent that this change took place, there have been several consequences of the nationwide ban documented, even though there's some limits to the data that's available. So I found a 2023 report from the Georgetown University Center on Education and the Workforce. And this was actually released in anticipation of the ban. And we see, you know, the ban did take place. So in this report, the researchers actually used predictive models to test if selective institutions would be able to maintain their existing racial diversity by utilizing socioeconomic class conscious admissions practices after race conscious affirmative action was banned. So they basically ran a bunch of simulations on distinct admissions models that focused on different things like academic merit, socioeconomic status, high school class rank, and combinations of those things with and without the consideration of race and ethnicity. And in their simulations, they concluded that institutions may be able to maintain the current racial equity gaps that we have and not increase them, but they wouldn't be able to close the racial equity gaps and increase their diversity without explicitly race-conscious admissions. And they advocated for race-conscious admissions, but also for socioeconomic class-conscious admissions, which can, you know, exist in tandem to promote fairness and equity. And they also advocated against admissions practices that unfairly benefit legacy students and student athletes who are disproportionately white. Some people have called legacy admissions and student athlete recruitment affirmative action for white people, which is an interesting kind of perspective to consider, I think. So that was their report. And again, that was predictive. So, you know, time will tell if those things will really play out the way they predicted, but it was interesting to see how they came to those conclusions. Also, a measured impact of the ban, AP News reported that enrollment of Black students has sharply dropped in the 2 years since the Supreme Court ruling. At 20 highly selective institutions, including Ivy League schools like Harvard, Columbia, and Yale, as well as a number of public flagship institutions. This was basically a group of 20 schools that they were able to get their enrollment data. A lot of places it was not made available to them. So Black student enrollment dropped very sharply, very notably. Asian American freshman enrollment rose modestly, and white enrollment, I think, was relatively steady. So that was, you know, a little disheartening to see that kind of immediate impact in that report. And then lastly, you know, if you follow the news, this is still very much an ongoing conversation, the ban and then kind of the enforcement of the ban. So we've been talking about, you know, ways that colleges and universities have still kind of maintained that they want to have a diverse student body and they want to take action to pursue that goal. But in lieu of using race-conscious admissions, they've, you know, used socioeconomic class or they've used other things as a proxy for race to try and reach that endpoint of racial equity and racial equality and racial diversity in their communities. However, these practices are also coming under scrutiny by the federal government. And, you know, recently the Trump administration has voiced opposition to the use of other applicant traits as a proxy for race in college admissions practices. So that is being increasingly scrutinized as well, and schools are getting, you know, threatened and kind of coerced into not doing anything that could be remotely interpreted as trying to suss out or use something as a proxy for race, basically. So I think that it is still a really dynamic and unpredictable moment, and this issue is very political and very polarizing. So that's kind of where we leave off in the current moment. I mean, it's an exciting time for sure. But I'm going to throw it back to Alicia, who's going to bring us through our conclusion. Thank you for listening.
Yeah, thank you so much, Madeline. That was a lot of information, a lot of heavy stuff, but it really set the tone for what our thoughts and feelings are about affirmative action in general. So like we just all talked about, that affirmative action in college admissions has been widely debated and challenged. We've seen research that shows that affirmative action policies have increased enrollment of historically excluded students in higher education, but we've also seen that these racial gaps have persisted throughout time. Those who oppose affirmative action have suggested that other policy solutions are necessary to ensure racial equity in college admissions, but contemporary bans have resulted in the widening of these racial disparities, as you just laid out. So whether the use of similar policies to those that were instituted in the 1960s or through the evolution of new policies and practices, leaders in higher education must take action if the existing racial equity gaps are to be addressed. We thank you all so much for joining us today. I want to thank my esteemed colleagues again. And we hope that you learned a little bit about the history of affirmative action in college admissions.